Hello and welcome to another Linguistics Career Cast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. This episode is an audio version of a virtual panel held at the Linguistics Career Launch in the summer of 2024, titled Societal Impacts and the Ethical Use of AI. The moderator is Aubrey Amstutz, and the two panelists are Patricia McDonough and Alfonso Sanchez Moya. In this session, the panelists reflect on the ethical impacts of AI and how qualitative researchers and linguists alike can address these issues in tech industries. We explore and recognize how linguistics is an integral component of the human evaluation of AI. Topics discussed include generative AI, ethics, qualitative research, technology, multiculturalism, fairness frameworks, LLMs, chatbots, and identity. Links to the panelists' LinkedIn profiles, the original YouTube video, and the resources doc mentioned are in the show notes. This episode of Linguistics Career Cast is generously sponsored by Amazon Science.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us. I'm really excited today because I get to chat with a few people who I know well, and I'm excited to hear about their work from this perspective, actually. But we're here today to talk a little bit about the ethical uses of AI and some of the societal impacts that can come from implementing AI at different points in a technological pipeline. First off, as Tamaya said, my name's Aubrey. My pronouns are she or they. The first AI product that I worked on was a language learning app back in 2019. And you can just imagine that since then, the last 3 years, there's been a lot of improvements, a lot of change, a lot of growth in this area. And that's really been getting me thinking a little bit about fairness issues and some of these representational harms. So representational meaning the representation of a group, the reputation of a group, that AI can kind of cause, especially for marginalized populations. And so in the last couple of years, I've been working as a researcher at Microsoft Research for a little bit on a project. I also worked in product policy at TikTok. And now I'm working as a vendor through Grid Dynamics on assignment at Apple as a research scientist, once again, thinking about how to test these AI systems and how to kind of quantify the risk that they might hold. So my focus has really been on biases, and these are societal biases, not machine learning biases, which are a little different. And these are related to the reputations of specific communities, as I said. So things like stereotypes and how those can show up in training data, and then how those can affect the downstream systems that use those. So I will go ahead and say thank you again to Tamaya for our Zoom producer. So she'll be providing any kind of useful resources in the chat that we might mention, as well as collecting the questions. So feel free to ask questions during the panel, but we probably will get to them at the end during a designated Q&A session. Okay, so we're really going to be just scratching the surface today because as you might imagine, this is as big as ethics is, as big as, you know, harm is, and that it can have so many different faces, right? And so we're only going to be like touching on a few things here, but I wanted to kind of help all of you start to be thinking about how you can be and how you can encourage the people you work with to be sort of informed consumers of this technology. So with that, I will jump into introducing my two panelists today. We have Patricia and Alfonso. So Patricia is a PhD linguist specializing in language documentation with a focus in morphosyntax. And she's currently working on a project at Microsoft measuring the risk of harm of various AI systems. So Patricia and I worked together actually a couple of years ago. So it's great to have you today, Patricia. Thanks for joining. And then Alfonso is a PhD linguist with a specialization in discourse analysis. So he is currently working as an AI ML data analyst at Amazon, working on Alexa, where he's been assessing the LLMs, assessing LLMs from an RAI, which is responsible AI perspective. And at the moment, he's also an adjunct professor at the Department of Applied Linguistics at UMass Boston. Okay, so let's get to know our panelists a little better from in their own words. So Trisha, would you mind introducing yourself and giving a quick overview of your experience with AI and ethics?
Yeah, thank you so much, Aubrey. It's great to be here. My name is Patricia, or Trisha. I typically go by by Trisha here in more casual settings. My background is in language documentation, specifically worked with languages in Northeast India. My PhD is from Indiana University. I work in tech here. Started as a human annotator via TELUS for Grammarly. Was with them for about a year. And then I have had two contract positions with Microsoft. So the first one was one that I worked with Aubrey in with the Microsoft Fairness Center in 2022. And then for the past year and some change, I've been working kind of more on the product side of things at Microsoft. My work has been on the evaluation side. So using AI for evaluation and evaluating AI generated content.
Great. Thank you. Okay, Alfonso, could you intro yourself and kind of just give a little blurb about how you've had to consider ethical AI applications so far in your work?
Yeah, thank you. Well, first of all, thank you, Aubrey. It's so nice to see you here. We were LCL 21 people, and I'm just so happy that you're moderating this panel, and then we'll have the chance to talk about the same topic. So yeah, thank you so much. I'm Alfonso Sanchez Moyas. As Aubrey said, I use pronouns he, him, and I do have a PhD in linguistics. It's a joint program both between Complutense University in Madrid and De Vrij Universiteit in Amsterdam. And actually, my PhD thesis was a very interesting exploration of online data, an online discourse. And that was a mixed method approach to understanding like a reality about, you know, specific social situations. In this case was partner violence. And that was kind of the origin and the spark, like where I started to realize that I was actually very much interested in everything around ethics and how we actually take ethics to online communication, online discourse, etc. So the interesting thing is that I started at Amazon like 2.5 years ago roughly, and I've been moving like shift, like changing like a lot, but it's true that priorities has been changing, like the technology has been changing drastically. So if I'm very happy to be part of this panel, it's because we spend a huge deal of time, like myself and my team, actually assessing textual data and doing pretty much the same thing that Trisha and Aubrey were commenting, like analyzing that data to make sure that, you know, that was compliant with different settings, you know, different criteria for fairness, it was not harmful, it was truthful, et cetera, et cetera. So I think to date, that's the, connection I've had with AI ethics in my job.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay, so first I'm going to kind of ask both of you to think of an example. So I'm sorry, this is not an interview. Don't worry, you don't have to do the star method. You can if you'd like. I'd like you to share a kind of specific example of a time you had to make one of these like informed decisions. So sort of what did you use to inform yourself? And what were the societal impacts that you had to consider? And obviously, I know some of this is under NDA. So just as much as you can share, we understand if you need to make some things kind of generic. Alfonso, do you want to start?
I don't mind. Yeah. That's actually nice that you mentioned this, Aubrey, because I think it's important to mention like responsible AI, AI ethics, etc. It's like a hot topic, obviously. I think whatever I'm going to be saying, it's not representing my company. It's just my experience at my company. But it's interesting that you mentioned this because I've had several examples of where I needed to kind of make people aware about the implications of including something in a large language model. This is very interesting, and I know this is a very hot topic also in the US, but coming from a European background, my understanding of, you know, weapons, guns, etc., is just completely different. Like that's not even something that it's part of our culture, and I know this is very controversial, and many people here have like completely different views on that. But to me, it was very interesting just to realize how working at big corporations and thinking of ethical implications of that. It's also interesting when it comes to whose ethics, right? Like this large language models being created, the companies producing and behind those, or the organizations behind those models. And sometimes it's so interesting when you're in a multicultural setting, in a multicultural team, when you're analyzing data that you go through it, and for you, it's completely disaligned with your beliefs and your understanding of what something, a worldview should be, right? And for me, it was super interesting, and that was a moment where I actually needed to raise my voice and say, well, I don't really think that a content that actually even slightly touches upon this idea of weapon carrying and permission and use of that, etc., should be treated this way or that other way. So that was an example of a time where I actually needed to, get deeper into like this situation, this societal issue here in the US, and how I saw it from a different perspective. And that made me reflect on these multicultural settings that maybe that's something that we can touch upon later on. But when we bring different sensitivities to organization, and we're thinking of something as big as you said, Aubrey, as ethics, which ethical system are we taking with us, right? So to me, that was a very, very interesting experience.
Thank you. Yeah, that's I you brought up so many points that I feel like we could do a whole panel just on all of those things, because yes, I find this over and over again. It's that you really need cultural expertise to do this well, not necessarily the machine learning expertise. There are lots, obviously you need that to do the implementation of these things, but I find over and over that that kind of nuanced understanding of these topics of things that are legal in some states and legal in others. It gets really tough in the United States when you're designing a product for the whole country and you have things like healthcare, weapons and drugs, illicit drugs are different in each state. And so you have to try to figure out not even ethics, but just even legality of it. And how do we treat these things culturally? Where do we want to align? We want to make sure that we aren't, aligning with sort of one worldview that we have here because we all happen to live in the Bay Area and have a very specific bubble that we inhabit, right? So how do we bring in those diverse perspectives? And then how do we make sure that the data actually has the right worldview, right? Every set of data has a worldview. Every corpus has a picture of the world that it has snapshotted. And we know it's not complete, but is it complete enough for what we're looking for what this AI system needs to do? Great. Okay, thank you so much. I don't want to get too excited and go on a long rant. So Trisha, can you please share an example of a time you had to make an informed decision and what sort of societal impacts were you thinking about?
And I'm so excited to be here with like getting to hear from and talk with both of you about this. Alfonso, that's yeah, like I'm just plus one to everything that Aubrey said there about like we could go on for I'm sure another like hour about all of this. But you brought up just kind of thinking about the worldview and cultures. Translation is not something that I've dealt with a lot myself, but it is something that I've seen come up kind of just big picture in a lot of these decisions about AI and when to use AI or not use AI. And so yeah, there's when you're kind of in industry and we're seeing just kind of this race to get stuff out as quickly as possible and also to scale to as many people as possible so that users in different parts of the world and different markets who are more comfortable speaking X language over Y language are able to use a given product. So there are a lot of benefits to using AI, using different models to try to do translation work. But okay, what are the risks that come with that? What happens when something doesn't get translated appropriately? Is it just kind of a funny like a funny little one-off error and everybody kind of laughs at it? Or is this like is this going to cause like confusion, or is this going to misrepresent something in a way that is like harmful to a person or to a broader group of people? So these sorts of decisions about when to use AI for something versus when to have a human get in there are just constantly coming up. And the decisions, just big picture decisions about translation being, I think, just one of those. And so I think like a few questions have come up for me just in day-to-day, multiple times a day, as any little given task comes up or bigger task. And there's this question of, okay, are we having a human do this or not? And that is like, is this a task that AI can do? Is it a task that AI should do? And if AI is being used in any sort of capacity for this, what kind of human oversight does it need? So it's just this constant, I think these kind of questions are constantly there. And, you know, the human evaluation component of any sort of AI, any sort of AI work, I think is really critical here.
Yeah. So much of it is just really making explicit all of these, like Alfonso was talking about before, right? We kind of have these, you know, our personal morality, our personal maybe kind of set of ethics that we feel we align with. And we don't often in everyday life get the opportunity to say those explicitly, to really like say, I think this is good and I think this is bad, these kind of like normative judgments, but we're making them all the time and they're just implicit. And I think that if you haven't had the training to like sit there and go like, okay, you know, how should this system act and who is it, whose ethics is it aligning with? It can be so easy to just condense that, that process and just say, well, obviously it should do this. Obviously it should treat people this way, without really like stopping and going like, is it obvious? I'm not sure. Yeah, thank you so much. So I thought I would just take a quick pause now that we've heard a little bit about the kind of applied version of this and just take a step back in case people aren't super familiar with responsible AI and just give a little bit of an overview of how this field is so large, right? I said that harm is so big. And so harm is even maybe only one area of responsible AI, but I'm going to kind of use one of the frameworks that is out there. So I'm going to use Microsoft's framework because this is what Tricia and I are really familiar with. And it's very similar from different frameworks from different companies or different like organizations. So the main principles of Microsoft's fairness framework or their responsible AI standard are fairness, reliability and safety, privacy and security, inclusiveness, transparency, and accountability. So I'm just going to touch on a few of these. So the idea that, so fairness is the idea that systems should treat people fairly, which by the way, does not mean equally necessarily. It means equitably. So what is kind of deserved to that group? So an example of equitable treatment would be like the affirmative action program that we had, which doesn't treat people equally. It specifically tries to like provide reparations in a way. And so fairness does not always mean that we just are colorblind or that we just totally remove societal or cultural factors from our analysis of how to treat people. We want to make sure that we are giving special attention to those who have previously not had it and have been kind of underserved by technology. So an applied example of this at a company like TikTok that I worked at or any kind of social media company would be thinking about their block list. Really, not even social media companies. I would say all companies, all tech companies have these kind of censored word lists, right? These block lists. You expect to not be able to use certain words, but how do those get updated? Who gets to update them? And how might those disproportionately affect marginalized groups? So if you think of slurs being reclaimed, slurs being okay for certain in-groups to use, when somebody is making a decision to block a word from a platform, especially if it's really, you know, well used or really influential, it can actually change the way that language is used. So it can actually prevent that reclamation. We saw with TikTok a while back that, you know, blocking the word suicide created the word unalive, right? And so we want to be thinking of these are the kind of societal impacts that I'm talking about, that these decisions that machine learning engineers might be making, if they don't have the support of linguists or social scientists, can have these downstream effects on society. Okay, so that was just a quick little like dive into one of the pillars of fairness. So you can kind of get an idea of what we're talking about when we say that we need these systems to be responsible to kind of all of the different user groups that might be interacting with it. Okay, so which of these kind of areas have you had the most experience with? And did you experience any perspective shifts or sort of unexpected discoveries in the process of getting kind of going deep with one of these. Do either of you want to start, or do you want me to pick? Trisha, you want to go first? Okay, thank you.
Sure. Yeah, happy to start here. Yeah. So the work that I've done has been pretty heavily in the fairness and inclusiveness kind of categories with this. My initial contract with Aubrey was with the Fairness Center, so they are you know, certainly very focused on that particular pillar, and that work has continued to really bleed into what I'm doing now. So thinking about thinking about different demographic groups, and for the product side of things, how is the product behaving here? How can we ensure that the product is responding equitably, for example, when queried about different demographic groups? Is it being not responding to queries about one demographic group and you know, responding to things about others? Or you know, that would be an example of like an erasure harm of you know, kind of erasing that demographic group. And then kind of similarly, but a different kind of direction with that, can the product be used like equitably by different demographic groups? So kind of thinking about a more linguistic side of this, if you have people speaking different varieties of English and they're using those different varieties of English with the product, is the product going to be able to respond in the same way to those different varieties, or is it going to be you know, better with some varieties than others?
Thank you. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I've seen a lot of great work on just comparing the accuracy of like transcription services, for example, ASR, between different social groups. And because there's all of this training data in there that doesn't represent that group. So for example, like with Black English, there's also this feedback loop, this positive feedback loop, where people, they try to use the product. So maybe they try to use like a voice assistant, and it doesn't work for them the first couple of times because it hasn't been trained on their version of English, their specific like phonological as well as grammatical structures. And so then they don't use it anymore. And so then guess what? What's training that voice assistant? It's all the people who are using it, is the continual data. So then it just continues to go down this little loop forever, where it's just getting trained on one specific group. And we think that that's fine. And not only is it like a fairness issue that we should just do something about because we care about people and we should do this, but also if you think of it from like a financial perspective, you're really missing out on like a large user group. So there's lots of different benefits, let's say, and different ways to kind of phrase these things when you're in a company where you need to make these you know, maybe profit-driven, in some cases, decisions. Okay, so Alfonso, can you please give a little overview of which of these like pillars you're most familiar with?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's pretty much aligned with what both of you have mentioned. So something that to me has been very interesting, and this is, I also have a very specific example that I think it's more suitable for one of the questions that afterwards, but okay. It's so interesting that when
feel
you
free
mentioned...
to, feel free to mention it if you like, in case we don't get to the question.
All right. Okay. I'll save it just in case. Okay. But it's interesting that I really like this question when you mentioned these unexpected discovery. And when I was kind of reflecting upon this question and kind of thinking of our role as linguists, also knowing that Trisha mentioned things about, you know, language documentation or, you know, different languages and translation, et cetera, et cetera. I recall a very specific occasion where I was assessing the output of that, you know, novel LLM, and that got me thinking about the role that we have in all this process when it comes to language variation and language change. Mm-hmm. And I'll be illustrating that like very briefly, but I remember once going through at very initial stages when we would actually assess like outcome, textual outcome from these hypothetical LLM. And I remembered like seeing so many instances of lexical substitution just to try to take one of the sources that the model would grab online. And then of course, working around that source and just trying to provide a response that it's not copy pasting what that source is actually providing.
Like what we did when we were in school, when we had to write it in our own words, right?
Exactly, right?
It's so, trying to do that.
Exactly. So I really found it very interesting, especially as a speaker of another language. I was just going through the output, and I will be illustrating that with an example in the chat. So I saw this, like this contrast. So, for example, I was seeing like the original source said, avoid wearing your leather jacket in rainy weather. And the outcome for the LLM would go for like in the event of rain, where you can see the obvious like change, avoid donning your leather jacket. That was the first time I actually saw that verb. And I remember going to the dictionary, just try to see what that word meant. And that got me thinking, and that's one of the moments where I actually enjoyed like this kind of role of being like gatekeepers sometimes. And I know that's very controversial, and I know that this is super like again, like whose ethics, whose assessment, et cetera, right? But that got me thinking about some words that may be kind of forgotten by now, and or maybe less known for people with a different, like, you know, world Englishes, et cetera, et cetera. And getting to revitalize them, right? Like just getting to see terms that we haven't seen in ages, decades, and we can check like different tools like Google Ngram, and what you see how that's been used over time, like different corpora. And then you see that that is a term that hasn't been used in a long time. And then that, you know, that made me reflect on like, okay, what if I leave this avoid donning as the kind of correct, assessly, nicely correct answer here? And in a way, I think that was very interesting when thinking of the role that linguists we have in all this process as well, in trying to maybe have an active role in these decisions. So yeah, that's a very specific example of a unexpected discovery of the societal impact that being in this position may also have.
Great. Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, that's really interesting. I think we just being aware, right? Like just the fact that you are aware is like the first and the huge step, right? Just knowing that you have that power and being like, wait a minute. Whoa, this is big. Let me think about this. That is the first step, and kind of verbalizing that, like within your group, just saying, "Hey, y'all, like this could have some impact. Like this is kind of a big deal. Let's think about it." Just even that little step, I think, is like just starting to get everybody thinking about these things is really the groundswell that we need to make these changes. Okay, great. So I would like to. I don't want to squeeze out our time for questions. And so I'm thinking I'm going to skip to the last question here, which is, how does being a linguist uniquely position you to work through these ethical decisions with your non-linguist teammates? And where do you see your background resulting in you having a sort of novel approach to an issue or a different perspective? Let's have Alfonso, since we were just chatting about these
All right.
kinds of discussions.
Okay. Yeah. And it is very timely because that was the actual question that I makes example was going for. So thank you.
Good.
No, I was going to mention very briefly here because as you both said, like I feel that we could talk about this like forever, but I'll try to be like very short. But a very another specific example of a moment where I recall like someone with our background, and it's true, Aubrey mentioned my background is discourse analysis, more specifically critical discourse analysis. So just being more aware, and as you said, Aubrey, this awareness around language that not even people in different subfields of linguistics may have, but I think my background, like being familiar with critical discourse analysis and this idea of language perpetuating stereotypes and language actually having the role to create realities, right? I remember a very specific instance where, again, like doing this exercise, we're asking the model a prototypical question and analyzing the hypothetical answer. I remember the question was like, oh, I'm interested in having my hair so silky and softer. What can I do? Like, can I use, I think the example was, can I use yogurt and honey to create a conditioner for that? Which again, like has interesting, maybe not very harmful in this case, but still, like you may don't want to experiment using like yogurt and honey for an air conditioner. But anyway, the interesting thing here is that the response got me like that really surprised me. And I was surprised that not everyone in my team actually realized about this. The response specifically said, unruly and like difficult hair is a very popular problem for many women around the world. And to me, that was fascinating, especially because that is very problematic at so many levels. Of course, you can stay at a very stereotypical level of, oh, well, not only women may just have like long hair, but also this understanding of only women worrying about having their hair silky and soft. You know what I mean? So to me, that was very interesting, especially seeing how a very tiny choice of word can actually change like the response at so many levels. So I think that was one of the moments where I just kind of like, hey, hold on a minute. My critical expertise in language tells me that maybe trying to adjust it in a different way might be actually fairer for different collectives of people who, you know, may just want to get their hair silky and whatever, not necessarily being identified as women. You know what I mean? So to me, that was super interesting. And I'll just stop there.
The nuance of stereotypes is makes it so difficult to find, right? It's like people are like, give me a slur list, I'll find it, no problem. But stereotypes, oh man, and they're visual too. Sometimes it's like the
Absolutely.
combination of things that are on the screen at the same time that is just like a bad association. But how do you even like document that? Like you need like an AI to describe the
I
image so
know.
you can get everything so you can look at the outputs. Oh my gosh, it gets so complicated with stereotypes. I personally love it. But anyway, let's get to Trisha. So do you feel like being a linguist has sort of set you up in a different way or given you a different perspective when you're working with, you know, these product folks and maybe engineers?
I'm gonna continue to just kind of just agree with like everything that has been said, you know, thinking about these different types of the output that we get from the models and being able to kind of pick up on these little pieces of things that are going on in the language that that others might not pick up on. But I think that really thinking about the context. So, you know, as linguists, we've been all trained broadly here to think about how people use language, how people are using language to communicate is, you know, kind of at the heart of a lot of what we're doing. And in working, you know, kind of on products, especially, you know, chatbot type products, you know, there are a lot of different ways that people might be going about trying to get at the same type of information. So, you know, thinking about those different ways that somebody might, you know, might query for something, or, you know, thinking about how people might say different things, but then kind of coming back into the responsibility side of things too. I think linguists are in a good position to be able to like represent why you can't just stick a bunch of stuff on a blacklist. Like Aubrey, you brought up the slur. So yeah, you know, it's often easier to do that, but you've got things with different terms being reclaimed. And so if a term is being reclaimed by a group, then having that on the blacklist and not being able to use that term at all is now negatively affecting that group and is affecting you know their ability to communicate and to use language. And when I first started with the Fairness Center work with Microsoft, my focus there was on disability and language surrounding disability, and that's continued to be something that I have explored. So just one little kind of example from the disability realm of things. First of all, there are just there are just a lot of preferences and individual preferences and different group preferences about what types of language to use surrounding disability. So, you know, some people prefer person first language. So, you know, I am Trisha is a person with OCD. Using, you know, talking about, you know, talking about my OCD first, or sorry, I'm not doing a good job of explaining
Yeah,
that.
no worries.
Talking about person first language versus identity first language is what I'm trying to get at here. And the point that I'm trying to make is that there's not a there's not a clear cut answer of, okay, we always should be using person first language, or we always should be using disability first identity first language. And so, you know, coming into the evaluation side of things, there's not, you can't just make a hard and fast rule. You have to think about, you know, preferences. You have to think about context. Crystal, thank you for helping me out here in the chat. and so I think that linguists are really good at presenting those different contextual pictures, whereas it might be the inclination of people who don't have kind of that background to try to make things a little bit more black and white. And
not only is there right like this consensus among the community that you're trying to represent or, you know, get information from, not only do you have to like hope that there's some sort of consensus among them as to how they would like to be referred to, and that's changing, but then also each person, if you think of each person in your own identity, right? Like, so I spend a lot of time thinking about like our identity groups or our like demographic factors, and so many of them are really, when you think about it, so many of them are mutable now, right? Like, I think a long time ago we might have thought, you know, you were born in one religion and that was your family's religion and that was you, and it wasn't really something you could change. And we thought same thing about gender and sexuality, and so now, and maybe even occupation, right? Going back, like, you were a tailor and that was your family's thing, and sorry, that's it. But now we're in this place where, like, in one lifetime you can be so many different things along all of those axes, and that can change. So the way you want to be described might change. You know, if you live in one place, you move to a new country, and then you describe yourself as a different race, depending on how they do their census, right? So all of these factors that we think of as being like core to a person, they actually change over time. And so it's really tough to not only want to describe the group correctly, but also just treat individuals how they want to be treated. How do we get that information in a systematized way so that we can actually treat them respectfully when how they want to be treated changes? So yeah, I think all of this is like, it gives us lots to work on, and I don't think that it's ever going to end. I think, you know, creatures are very mercurial. We're just going around changing. We're developing constantly, and we have to constantly keep up with that and try to reflect it as best we can. Okay, so I want to give some time for questions. So let me take a quick look. Tamaya, if you have any that you have
So
sort of seen that you want to pop up.
Aaron talked, asked, are there any organizations out there that have published guidelines on the ethical use of AI?
Yes, lots. So we actually have a little, I think there's like a Google Doc that Tamaya is going to share, where we list a bunch of different resources. So a bunch of books, also some organizations. So yeah, many of the you know, big tech players have their own like standards that they publish, which are great because, you know, they have the, because they have access to people making tech directly, they can try these things out, right? So they can create these kind of like little programs that you can go through that has like a role for the product engineer and a role for the, you know, legal person, and everybody knows what they're doing, and you can follow these little projects and have these discussions and then get to some sort of conclusion. So that's really nice. Those are coming from those, from the like tech players. But there's also a lot of organizations, governmental, you know, NGOs, things like that, that are putting together like external audits. So I think it's really nice to have a balance of both. You need like the same as we need like academia and industry to like sort of balance each other out, and academia needs to be able to critique what industry is doing. I think that when you're looking for resources, you should always try to get a little bit of a balanced you know, set of perspectives. So yeah, there's a great resource doc there. Tamaya, were there other questions?
Yes. And one question was, when you identify ethical issues, what do you do so that the product gets improved in the right direction?
Great question. Trisha or Alfonso, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I'll just share a little bit here. You know, it's, I am right now part of a responsible AI team. So we are the team that's like working to identify those sorts of issues. So ideally, a group would have some folks that are dedicated to this sort of work. I will say one thing that's that really is like valuable with a product, at least for us, is when people provide feedback. So if there's an answer that comes up, you know, with a product that you think is stereotyping, or that's, you know, just you know, unfair, inappropriate, whatever the problem is, like I encourage people to provide feedback if that's an option. And even the ability to provide that feedback is part of this like ethical AI, and more of the design type thing. But yeah, provide that feedback, let the product team know, and hopefully they will, you know, do something about that. But yeah, participate too in that way as an individual.
Yeah, those kind of like opportunities for like informed consent about how data is being used, as well as the opportunities to give your feedback and feel like you're really part of it, are really a big part of the transparency and accountability pillars. Okay, Alfonso, did you have anything?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think that's super interesting. And I think something that it's in our ability is just this idea of creating awareness. And I think that's not something people are used to. And people like at different levels, obviously software engineers have different things to worry about, but they may not be as aware about like language biases or stereotypes that we mentioned before, Aubrey, right? So I think something crucial that we bring to the table is this awareness around language and you know, what the implications that might have. So I think that having an active role in that process is super interesting. I know that, for example, at Amazon, not only did we actually evaluate a model data, like the data with which that the model was going to be trained, but we're currently actually assessing the output of the actual model, and there are dedicated teams to actually analyze responses from the model just to see how that's ethical, like, you know, how the ethics of that it's compromising. So I think that having an active role in all those processes, all those different workflows, and raising awareness around that, I think those are like key factors.
Yeah, definitely. I think whenever you have the opportunity to just mention it, even if it doesn't go anywhere, I think the more times you do that, the more likely in the future they'll come to you and say, hey, we found this thing, you know, it's kind of weird. Yes. What do you think? And then you
Absolutely.
Start to become the linguist on staff, that they're like, hey, we found this weird language thing, if you don't have other linguists on your team. Great. Any other questions?
Yeah. Possibly the last one is, how much background knowledge in coding or machine learning is required for someone interested in ethical AI, particularly in the area of equity, diversity, and inclusion?
Yeah, this is the classic question. And this is a question that I asked at every single panel when I was a participant a couple of years ago, because I was very concerned. So you're going to hear really different things from different folks. I have been able to get away with not having deep programming knowledge. I don't find it super exciting to learn like the kind of logic tricks and like the different like special little, you know, how to program an elevator or whatever you have to do to be able to like do a tech interview. And so if that was something that was required, I felt that I didn't want to actually get myself into a situation where, like, kind of Mark mentioned this a couple of sessions ago, that you don't really want to get yourself into a situation where you can't do the thing that's expected of you anyway. And if you're not super interested and you don't want to learn it, then like, know that about yourself, I think. And that takes time and trial and error, right? So like finding out whether or not that's something that's really sparks your interest. So for me, I feel that my time is better spent reading books about like societal issues, right? Like reading kind of books about race, reading, you know, memoir, essay collections from different identity groups who maybe haven't had kind of a lot of public opinion or public kind of conversation about their issues. So like, for example, reading a little bit about like non-white feminism, like things like that. I feel like I get so much more out of that that I'm able to bring. And that's what I bring, like that's my unique gift, is to be able to bring this kind of societal and like cultural understanding to the tech systems that we're working on. So for me, that's where I feel that I want to focus my efforts, but that's a very personal decision. I have been able to get away with it. It has definitely cost me some, you know, prompt engineering and things like that, where sometimes people still think it needs to be really engineering. It's cost me some opportunities in that way, but I don't think that they were the right ones that were going to be aligned with what I want to be spending my days every day doing anyway. So it's a very personal decision. Trisha or Alfonso, you have like 1 minute, sorry.
Yeah, this has also been on my mind very much over the past few years. I have also been able to get away with not having that deep knowledge. I've gone back and forth with various like introductory programming coding things. I think that having some level of understanding, because you're going to be working with folks that do a lot of coding, is helpful. But I think it has been an uphill battle not having that background, but I'm really hoping that more industries, more companies really start to pick up on the role that more of this social science linguist background can contribute in these areas. Again, it's an uphill battle, but
Yes, I
yeah,
agree.
we're
That's
continuing to
very
push
true.
for
It's very
it.
true. There's still a lot of bias against, like you'll see in the job descriptions, linguistics is the last one mentioned for the degrees or something. And you're like, oh, but I'm hoping that we're going to get it switched in some in the future where they first want a linguist and then maybe if you have some comp sci background. But we're working on it. We're not there yet. Alfonso?
And yeah, very brief, that's briefly here, but also we should take into account that, maybe we didn't start our current positions knowing that we were going to do what we're doing, like and be
Yes.
connected to this responsible AI. I think that's a very exciting time for us with having this criticality around language, especially when all these huge products start to be used by actual customers and users and people. I have the impression that many, many corporations, organizations will be even more aware of having to test that through people who may have that sensitivity. So absolutely, I think we are getting there, and I'm really hoping that like we actually have the chance to be a part of those discussions.
Yeah, I heard Chris say Chris S. I'm blanking if it's Stewart on his last name,
Stuart.
but yeah, thank you. Yes, I heard him say the phrase English is the hottest new coding language because because of all of the LLM interfaces now. So hopefully that's where we're going. Okay, great. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining. Please check out the resources. Definitely, connect with me on LinkedIn. I love to kind of see what everybody's up to and share resources, et cetera. So feel free to reach out. Thank you so much, Tricia and Alfonso, for joining us today. And thank you to Maya as well.
Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held two online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.